From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Nelson Mandela is given an African and an international send-off in Johannesburg, where international leaders, past and present, came together to pay their respects to the late South African president.
And while I will always fall short of Madiba's example, he makes me want to be a better man.
The service in Johannesburg also saw the American and Cuban presidents exchange a handshake. We look at how that gesture has been received. We talk to anti-war and anti-poverty groups as they gather in the shadow of a US defense bill. And NASA celebrates 15 years of the International Space Station.
The end goal to have the tremendous capability to have an orbiting laboratory operated with permanent human presence.
That's later on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. President Barack Obama has paid tribute to Nelson Mandela at his memorial service in Johannesburg. Tens of thousands of people attended the event. World leaders, including Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, UK Prime Minister David Cameron, Cuban President Raul Castro, and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon were among the guests. Current South African President Jacob Zuma was roundly booed as he entered the arena. A handshake between President Obama and President Castro also made waves. The greeting is being seen as highly symbolic, 50 years after Washington cut diplomatic ties with Havana. Referring to him by his clan name, Madiba, Barack Obama told the cheering crowd that Nelson Mandela's legacy needs to be worked at.
There are too many people who happily embrace Madiba's legacy of racial reconciliation, but passionately resist even modest reforms that would challenge chronic poverty and growing inequality.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is urging members of the United States Congress not to introduce new sanctions against Iran, saying the world community is at a delicate diplomatic moment in its negotiations with Tehran. The Secretary of State was testifying on Capitol Hill, as Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
With Republicans pushing for the imposition of a fresh batch of sanctions on Iran, John Kerry's message was simple: don't do it yet. He told the House Foreign Relations Committee that the diplomatic track with Tehran needs to be given a chance to work.
Once implemented, and it will be in the next weeks, this agreement halts the progress of Iran's nuclear program. Halts the progress and rolls it back in certain places for the first time.
But the Obama administration knows it has work still to do, heading off the prospect of fresh sanctions. So the Secretary of State will be back on Capitol Hill on Wednesday.
Expanding Russia's military presence in the Arctic is one of the top priorities for the country's armed forces, Russian President Vladimir Putin said on Tuesday. Several countries, including Russia, Canada, Norway, the United States, and Denmark, have been trying to assert their jurisdiction over parts of the Arctic, where nearly a quarter of the world's undiscovered oil and gas deposits are located. Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
Russian President Vladimir Putin told the country's top military commanders that, quote, next year we have to complete the formation of new large units and military divisions in the Arctic that remain on constant combat alert. He added that Russia must possess all the levers necessary for protecting its security and national interests in the region. Earlier this year, the country's military started to overhaul its Soviet-era base at the New Siberian Islands, which is believed to be a key facility for protecting shipping routes linking Europe with the Pacific across the Arctic Ocean.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Denmark is set to become the latest country to join a French-led operation aimed at battling the Islamic insurgency in Mali. The Scandinavian country joins an international coalition in assisting France's attempts to intervene. The move follows the discovery of six bodies by an AP journalist, seen as the first concrete evidence of ethnic violence. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Denmark is sending a military transport plane to assist Mali's embattled government and its French allies to push down a 10-month-old Islamic insurgency in the country's north. The addition of Denmark to a French-led mission involving the US, the UK, Belgium, Spain, and Canada follows the discovery of six bodies by an AP journalist which human rights activists blame on Mali's military. French aircraft have been attacking the Islamic rebels since Friday.
Key American financial regulatory bodies are voting on the blocker rule, new regulations intended to limit banks' trading. The goal of the new rules are to prevent another instance of the London whale, where J.P. Morgan lost over $6 billion in bad trades. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff has more.
Central to the Volcker Rule is the concept that trades to hedge against possible losses in bank portfolios, financial institutions now must demonstrate the hedge bet reduces or otherwise significantly mitigates one or more specific identifiable risk, according to the text. American regulators want to ensure that banks do not take unnecessary risks that threaten their stability. The rule is aimed at protecting deposits and capital. However, financial institutions have said the Volcker Rule is confusing because it could prevent them from market-making moves for profit.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. What a magnificent soul it was. We will miss him deeply. May God bless the memory of Nelson Mandela. May God bless the people of South Africa.
Barack Obama speaking to a stadium packed with tens of thousands of people in Johannesburg, all there to remember the life and legacy of South Africa's first black president, Nelson Mandela. And Mr. Obama was given a rapturous reception, far better than that of the current South African leader, Jacob Zuma, who was greeted by boos when he rose to speak.
Graça Machel, Mama Winnie Madikizela Mandela, and the entire Mandela family, dear South Africans, that we are Madiba's compatriots and have lived during his time is a cause for a great celebration and enormous pride.
Well, that four-hour-long memorial service was one of the largest gatherings of international dignitaries in recent years, with more than 100 current or former heads of state. But also in the stadium were thousands of South Africans who wanted to say goodbye to the man they called Madiba. One of them was lawyer Narisha Singh, who spoke to FSN's Lorna Shaddick. She began by explaining why she wanted to attend the event.
I couldn't imagine being anywhere else. I left my home at 3:30 this morning and got to the stadium at 5 a.m., and it was the most, you know, emotional journey, I think, getting there. I don't think the world expected us to celebrate. And really, it has been a celebration. I mean, when we got to the gates at 5 a.m., people were dancing, people were singing liberation songs, people were chanting, you know, just random strangers just talking and exchanging their own Madiba moments. And I think the reason why I went there today was, you know, just to show the world and show South Africa, you know, how much Madiba meant to us. You know, I joined literally tens of thousands of people, you know, getting into the stadium, trying to find the right spot, trying to get out of the rain, you know, helping kids, helping youngsters as well, sharing stories as we waited for 5 hours before the event started. For me, it's been a very personal journey because I lived during apartheid. I was 13 when Nelson Mandela was released. I was 17 when we had our first democratic elections.
And you mentioned there people were sharing stories, and despite the rain, there was a good atmosphere. Tell us a little bit more about what it was like to be there today, and indeed any stories, good stories that you heard from other people.
The word that comes to mind is electric. People were dancing from the moment we got there. I mean, literally, even before the gates opened, at 5 a.m., people started dancing, and people have been singing, and you can hear from my voice as well. I hardly have a voice because we were screaming and shouting. People didn't even focus on the rain. Nobody talks about the weather. In South African culture, in African culture, in Indian culture, when there's a death in the family and it rains and it's a very good sign, it's a lucky charm for the individual that has passed on. I met one individual. Her grandmother lived in just outside of Pietermaritzburg. And just before Mandela was arrested in Pietermaritzburg, he was actually hiding out in her house.
There were, certainly we noticed here in DC, there were quite a few boos for Jacob Zuma during his speech. Did you take part in that?
No. You know, I have to say, I was so surprised when it started. And, you know, I was in a group of people and we were trying to actually shush the crowd. You know, the people around us that were doing the hand gestures, you know, when you want to do a substitute in a football match and you roll your hands together. And the boos were quite loud in our section, but it actually came from all over the stadium. Personally, I understand. I think a lot of South Africans are disillusioned. I mean, we've got a president who's embroiled in a huge multi-million rand corruption scandal. And I can understand why people are feeling the way that they do. But as a South African, I have to say today, I was embarrassed because this was not the right moment.
And were there any standout good moments for you? Any particular speeches?
One thing what stands out for me, I think I'll say, is the South African people. I think how we all got together, you know, showed up at a stadium despite the persistent rain. And people came in good spirits and they actually left in good spirits. You know, in good times and bad times, people rally together, and I really saw that today. Barack Obama, he gave an amazing speech. You know, he really rallied the crowd. You know, I called my family, and I said to them I was going, and they thought I was crazy. But I said, you know, I just cannot imagine being anywhere else, and I will never forget today. Just as I will never forget being 13 years old and, you know, hearing that Nelson Mandela was going to be released from prison. So lots of moments in my journey, in my own personal journey, that will stay with me for the rest of my life, including today as well.
Lawyer Narisha Singh. Now, as Barack Obama made his way to address the crowds attending Nelson Mandela's memorial, he first passed a line of other world leaders and dignitaries. But it was the US leader's decision to shake the hand of Cuban President Raul Castro that sparked immediate scrutiny and debate. Philip Peters, president of the Cuba Research Center in Washington, gave me his reaction to that handshake.
But I think it would even be a bigger news story if he hadn't done so. After all, he went up on the dais, was greeting all the fellow speakers. There were six heads of state that were going to speak, including Obama and Raul Castro. And I think it would have been extraordinary for him to skip over one and not even shake the man's hand.
How do you think that handshake is playing out both in the U.S. and in Cuba?
Well, I think that in the United States, I think there are going to be some who say he shouldn't, under any circumstances, even look at him, much less shake his hand. But I think most people would see that it's not a very significant act. It was a matter of protocol. He was greeting a group of people. Raul Castro was among that group, and he greeted him. I think the much more important thing is whether Obama is going to take steps to change the relationship with the United States, between the United States and Cuba, which requires dialogue, which requires give and take on both sides. But that requires a decision, not a handshake. That's a much bigger issue.
But this handshake, no doubt, will act as a springboard, whether President Obama wants it or not. This will become a discussion beyond today's event.
Well, and I think that would be a good thing. And after all, President Obama has invited that discussion because he was just in Miami a few weeks ago, and he gave a speech where he said that our policy towards Cuba is as old as I am, and it needs to be updated. And he has not said what kind of updating, and of course he's the one who has the power to do it. So he's invited the question of what to do about this antiquated and counterproductive policy. So I hope this handshake does spur that. That would be a healthy thing.
Philip Peters of the Cuba Research Center in Washington. One of those politicians with close connections to Nelson Mandela is the British MP Peter Hain. He grew up in South Africa and his parents were anti-apartheid activists. He moved to the UK as a teenager and became a lead figure in the anti-apartheid movement in Britain. Mr. Hain spoke to our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead about Nelson Mandela's impact on British politics.
Parliament wants to pay its respects to Nelson Mandela, who had a touching faith in British parliamentary democracy here, even when the majority in Parliament and the government of the day did not support him, or the African National Congress, or the anti-apartheid movement that we organised to try and get Nelson Mandela free and South Africa liberated. It was the anti-apartheid movement, which was strongest here in Britain, that fought for his cause, that fought for the freedom for all South Africans, regardless of race, that fought for the abolition of and the overthrow of apartheid through sanctions and boycotts, interrupting Springbok tours, preventing them from touring, trying to get British companies, instead of propping up apartheid, to disinvest. That struggle, that campaign, was the one that brought about Nelson Mandela's release, as he never tired of saying.
What will his political legacy be to not only South Africa, but politicians worldwide?
To South Africa, it'll be the person, the leader, the only leader who could have made the transition from a bitterly divided country to a nation, the rainbow nation that we saw under his presidency and continues today. To the world, he stands for not just his courage and his strength of leadership, which were immense, but also for being such a wonderful person, a people's person. His humanity radiated like a warm glow from him. And that is why I think he's held in such universal affection right across the world, regardless of country, everywhere. He is the one leader that everybody looks up to, and that says something for him.
Tell us about maybe some times with you've met Nelson Mandela, and what was he like as a person to meet?
He was a fantastic person to meet, not just because you realized you were in the presence of greatness, that was just apparent being in the same room as him, but because he was such a nice person. And that isn't the case with a lot of world leaders. He was a genuine people's person. He, for example, when I mentioned to him after he'd inquired after our family that my mother had broken her leg in hospital, he said, I must speak to her. I had to get my mobile phone out, track down the phone number, I didn't have it, find her finally. While he was chatting to hotel porters and waiters and cleaners, he always had time for the ordinary person. Finally, I got her on the phone and said to my mother, a special person to speak to you, handed the phone to him, and he said, this is Nelson Mandela from South Africa. Do you know who I am? He had that impish, mischievous sense of humor, and he always was teasing everybody he met.
Obviously, at the moment, we're re-watching Mandela's speeches, and we're talking about what his legacy is. How will that legacy be ensured, and how will it be maintained for future generations?
Well, Nelson Mandela's shoes are very big ones to fill, maybe impossible. But the leaders that have followed him need to do much better to step up to the values, the mark that he set, the very high standards he set of absolute honesty and integrity and principle, regardless of whether it suited his party or his government or not. That's missing a bit in South Africa today. And whilst the African National Congress still reflects the values of democracy and social justice that Nelson Mandela preached, it's still necessary that the leadership puts into practice those values.
Today is International Human Rights Day, the 65th anniversary of the adoption of the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Anti-war and anti-poverty groups gathered on Capitol Hill today to blast members of Congress for scrambling to pass a more than $600 million bill to fund the military before leaving for the holidays, but taking no action so far on preventing impending cuts to food stamps and unemployment benefits. A deal struck by Democrats and Republicans this week will soon require a final vote on the massive defence bill, but will not allow lawmakers to make any amendments. On Capitol Hill, Alice Ulstein reports.
The House of Representatives aims to vote on the more than $600 billion National Defence Authorization Act by the end of this week. They then plan to leave town for the holidays, forcing the Senate to pass the bill as is early next week. Arizona Republican John McCain told FSN he finds this arrangement undemocratic.
I know that there are concerns amongst my Republican colleagues that they will not be allowed to propose amendments, which is in direct contradiction to the way the Senate is supposed to operate.
But the architects of the deal, including Michigan Democrat Carl Levin, chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, told reporters Monday that they are limiting debate and banning amendments not out of choice, but necessity.
There's no way we can consider amendments, pass a bill, go to conference with the House, get a conference report written, and have a conference report adopted by the House of Representatives before Friday.
Levin said that in the rush to pass the bill before the end of the year, Republicans and Democrats had to compromise on several key issues, including the fate of the more than 100 remaining detainees at the Guantanamo Bay prison, dozens of whom have already been cleared for release, and the majority never charged with a crime.
The bill basically takes half of what we did in the Senate, and that is to give flexibility to the president to transfer detainees from Guantanamo to third countries. It maintains the prohibition on transferring detainees here And there's about half of the detainees would be detainees that could be transferred to their third world countries from which they come. About half of the detainees would remain in Guantanamo because of the prohibition on transferring them to the United States for detention and for trial.
As other congressional committees meet behind closed doors this week to negotiate a budget for next year that includes the deep cuts they themselves imposed, the proposed military budget would restore several billion dollars of cut funding to the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, National Guard, and U.S. Special Operations Command. The bill also authorizes nearly $81 billion for the war in Afghanistan, which officially ends next year, though the U.S. is currently negotiating with the Afghan government to maintain a major military presence for at least a decade. Speaking to reporters and activists Monday, former Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein said this spending goes hand in hand with the government's failure to meet essential human needs.
We cannot both feed the hungry, feed our children, feed our elders, and feed us, and feed this absolutely bottomless pit of the military machine. So we have to make a choice, not only in terms of our economics, but also in terms of the kind of world that we want to live in.
As Congress rushes to pass the military budget through both chambers of Congress before Christmas, there has been no movement on a bill introduced several weeks ago to fund the extension of benefits for the long-term unemployed, which are set to expire for more than a million people on December 28th. These are people who, despite actively looking for work, have been unemployed for 27 weeks or longer. Lawmakers are also considering cutting the food stamp benefits of more than 1 million people, building on cuts that went into effect at the beginning of November that reduced benefits to less than $1.40 per person per meal. The Budget Conference Committee plans to announce their final decisions on the food stamp cuts this week. In Washington, I'm Alice Holstein.
One of the key provisions of the U.S. financial law designed to prevent the kind of Wall Street collapse we saw in 2008 has been completed. The Volcker Rule, named after a former Federal Reserve chairman, restricts the ability of conventional banks from indulging in risky speculation. Bartlett Naylor is an expert on corporate governance at Public Citizen and explained the rule to our Washington correspondent, Daniel Renches.
The Volcker Rule that essentially says that with the government-guaranteed money that banks use, they shouldn't gamble. They shouldn't engage in short-term speculative trading. They should instead do the normal thing that banks were intended to do with that government-guaranteed money, and that is make patient loans to commercial businesses and home buyers and consumers.
And what's happened today, then, as this rule essentially passed through the Congress, then?
Yes, the landmark day. 3+ years after the bill was passed, the regulators finally translated the statute, what Congress approved, into the rules of the road, the rules by which banks technically have to behave. Why this is complicated or why this took so long is mostly because there's a Wall Street tsunami of lobbyists that want all kinds of exemptions built into it. But also the statute provided that banks can do one thing that spills into the bad thing. They can do a thing called market making. And that means meeting the demands of customers that want to purchase or sell a security. When a bank does that, they can either do it as a broker where they don't actually take possession, or they can do it as a dealer where they actually take possession of that security. The hazard takes place if the bank has knowledge and knows that the security is a good thing for it to buy before it sells it again. And there's a lot of mischief that can take place between within that transaction, and it's that difficulty that the regulators struggled with. And unfortunately, they didn't have too much help from Wall Street that didn't want to make it clear. They wanted to make it complex so that they could continue the prop trade. It's worth something like $40 billion a year to them.
And do you think that intervention by the lobbyists from Wall Street will have an impact on the level of risk that ordinary Americans and indeed people around the world face in a future financial crisis?
Well, there is a contest. Just as if you're driving down a highway, you'd really like to get there as quickly as possible, and there's that tendency to speed. Yes, this is highly profitable enterprise to engage in proprietary trading. The strength of this rule is, as in any business school, you learn that what is measured is managed, and what will be completely different now is that firms will have to document the nature of their market making. Right now, these flow traders sit at desks and they are buying and selling, and they're not having to record that they actually have a customer, that their inventory is rising in IBM stock. Now there'll be eight different metrics that will be able to test whether or not they're truly meeting customer demand or they are prop trading for the bank itself. So I think this is a big step forward. This is a landmark day. The regulators, of course, have to enforce it.
FSN's Daniel Renches talking to Bartlett Naylor. Finally tonight, one of the most ambitious construction projects ever undertaken turns 15 years old today. The International Space Station is an orbiting science lab, and NASA hopes it'll play a crucial role in research aimed at eventually getting astronauts to Mars. But the ISS isn't without controversy, as our US correspondent Steve Mort reports from Orlando.
Construction began on the International Space Station 15 years ago, and it's been permanently occupied by astronauts since Expedition 1 blasted off in October 2000. The complex has more livable room than a six-bedroom house and even has a gym. The orbiting outpost has become a symbol of international cooperation, but also a lab where science experiments can be carried out in zero gravity. Nancy Curry was one of the members of the crew of the first ever space shuttle mission to the ISS.
The end goal, to have this tremendous capability to have an orbiting laboratory operated with, you know, permanent human presence for decades, is a reality. And, you know, it was just wonderful to be there from the start and literally turn on the lights.
But it wasn't always plain sailing for the International Space Station. Critics have called the ISS an orbiting white elephant. At a cost of $150 billion to build, some have questioned the need for the station. Astronaut Jerry Ross, a mission specialist who was also on the first shuttle mission to the ISS, says early on there was a perception among the public that NASA was squandering money on the project.
Well, that was one of my frustrations early on with the stations. We weren't doing as much science, or at least it wasn't being well enough explained or spread. And I kept pestering people to do a better job of getting the information out, not only to the public, but also to the astronaut office, so we had more knowledge that we could spread when we were out visiting and talking to folks.
With America's shuttle fleet now consigned to history, Russia's taking the lead on carrying astronauts to the International Space Station, upsetting some veterans of NASA's manned spaceflight program. But in 2015, a Russian cosmonaut and an American astronaut will begin a one-year mission to the ISS aboard a Russian Soyuz. Alexei Krasnov is Russia's director of piloted space programs.
We should take some risks upon ourselves, risks connected with the one-year mission, and we'll try to determine the negative impacts that this long-duration flight might have on the body, on the human body.
But at the same time, China's stepping up its efforts to build its own space station. Beijing is not part of the International Space Station program and expects to have its own orbiting outpost finished by 2020, complete with an ability to house three long-term residents. Steve Mort, Orlando.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show by emailing us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. Coming up on Wednesday, we look at the ethnic violence and humanitarian crisis gripping the Central African Republic. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.